Hashem gathers a Jewish nation at the Mount of Har Sinai, and the entire Jewish nation, man, woman, and child, stand there and they hear the words Anochi Hashem Elokecha. But it wasn't just hearing Hashem, it was a divine revelation to the extent that everyone there, 3 million people, saw and recognized that Hashem is the creator of the world, maintainer of the world, and orchestrates everything in creation. And the Gemara explains to us they reached a level of Nevuah, absolute clarity, prophecy. They all understood why we're here, what life's about. There were no questions, no fog. Everything was clear. They experienced Hashem, and they knew that Hashem is the creator and one who runs the world. Moshe Rabbeinu then tells the Jewish nation to wait. He's going to go up to receive the Torah. And he goes up for 40 days. And at the end of these 40 days begins the Chet HaEgel. Basically, at a certain point, as the pasuk says, Ki Boshe Shmored Moshe L'Eretz Minahar, Moshe was late. He was supposed to come down earlier, and people began questioning, where is he? And the Sultan had a field day. He made it dark in the world, and he brought an image of Moshe Rabbeinu out on a coffin, as if to say Moshe had died. And apparently, the Jewish people believed that Moshe was no longer alive. And at that point, they gather together, and they say to Aaron, make for us an Egel Masecha. What exactly this means, most of the Jewish people certainly did not intend for an Avodah Zarah, for an idol worship, but they certainly had some level, there was some mistake in their thinking, in their understanding. Aaron saw that if he didn't give in on some level, it would be total anarchy, either they'd kill him, or who knows what. So he delayed them, he tried his best. Chag Hashem Lamocha, tomorrow will be the Chag towards Hashem. He takes the gold from everyone, throws it into the fire. Out comes this eagle. And Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Lech raid, go down. Ki shiches amcha, your nation has rebelled. They're now serving idols. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down and he sees, in fact, the eagle. He smashes the eagle. He says to the Jewish people, you've sinned. Those who actually served the Avodah Zarah were 3,000, those were killed. And then Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jewish nation, I'm going to go back up and I'm going to see whether I can ask Hashem for atonement. See, Moshe Rabbeinu understood that the fate of the Jewish people was in his hands. Hashem already explained to him that he was ready to destroy, annihilate the entire Jewish people. After seeing Hashem with such clarity just a few days earlier, and now after the small gap to, on some level, serve Avodah Zarah, and certainly 3,000 actually did serve idols, it was such a rebellion that Hashem said they're no longer worthy, but Moshe Rabbeinu knew it was dependent upon him. He says to the Jewish people, Chet Gadol Chata, you sinned a great sin. Let me go up and see. Maybe I can be mechaper. Maybe I can ask Hashem to forgive you. And Moshe Rabbeinu goes up, and he says to Hashem, as the pasuk says, Ana Chata Amazeh Chata Gadola. This nation has done a great sin. Ve'asal Melkei Zav, they made golden calves. Please forgive them. If not, wipe me out from your sefer. Count me out of the book. And the Gemara explained to us that Moshe Rabbeinu was really pushing the limits. He realized it was his tefillah, his bequest that would make the day or not. And he really pushed the limits. And he said to Hashem, either forgive the Jewish nation or count me out. I'm not part, erase me from the Sefer Torah. I don't want to be any more part of this. And after pushing and pushing, Hashem acquiesced. And in fact, Moshe Rabbeinu comes back down 40 days later. It's Yom Kippur. He tells the Jewish people, Kapara has been granted. And from that day on, we have Yom Kippur as the day of Slicha and Mechila. And this is the basic story of what occurred. But there's one thing compelling that Rashi explains to us. That when Moshe Rabbeinu went back up, he said to Hashem, they made Elokei Zahav. They made gods of gold. And Rashi explains to us the name of the Gemara. Moshe wasn't just saying they made gods of gold. He was actually complaining, Atahu Shegaramt Hashem, you caused it. You caused this to happen. Why? Look what you gave them. They left with gold, with silver. You gave them everything they wanted. Of course they're going to sin. They left Mitzrayim. They despoiled all the wealth of Mitzrayim. They had such wealth, such tremendous ashiras. How is it possible that they didn't sin? You caused it, Hashem. And then Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'll give a mashal. Imagine a king takes his son and he feeds his son and he dresses him and he puts him in the Pesach Beis Hazonos. He puts him at the foot of the house of ill repute. Mayasa ben Melechta, isn't it obvious that this teenager, this person is going to sin? But Atta Garamta, Hashem, you caused it. And not only was Moshe Rabbeinu effective in this, the Gemara says Hashem was Moda, Hashem agreed. And this apparently was a big part of the way that Moshe Rabbeinu solved this total annihilation, saved the Jewish people, and by saying, Hashem, you were at fault. Now, I'd like to try to understand this Rashi, if we can, because it is rather perplexing. Because what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying to Hashem is, you're guilty because you gave them so much wealth. And not only did you give them so much wealth, and they were so wealthy that I want to give you a comparison. It's like taking a young man and putting him on the doorstep of sin. How is it possible not to sin? Now let's focus on this. This is the Jewish nation after hearing Hashem say, Anochi Hashem Lakecha. They saw Hashem. They understood Hashem. So they had money. So they had gold. Therefore what? How is that going to bring them to Avodah Zarah? See, we get confused. Money is gold. It's glittery. It looks tremendous. But they understood the purpose of life. And they recognize exactly what life is about. They recognize we're here for a few short years. Every mitzvah makes me, shapes me for eternity. Every avera damages me. For us, we're confused, but they saw it. And they saw it with prophecy. But even more, they're living in the Midbar. This generation is living now in the desert. What exactly are they going to do with their money? Let's say you're right, they have bags and bags of gold. They're phenomenally wealthy. And what are you going to do with your money? How could the money have brought them to sin? They don't buy, they don't sell. And they're not in commerce, they're not in business. But even more than that, what did they do all day? This was the ultimate Kollel society, and these were the people who were supposed to be learning all day, which is really what they did. They ate mun, that was their food, and if you understood what mun was, you would quickly recognize that it's very, very difficult to see these people sin. You see, the mun was left exactly at your doorstep based on what level you were on, meaning if you were a great tzaddik, the mun was right by your door. If you were sort of a Beinoni, then you had to take a little bit of a walk. The mun for your family was left a little bit further. If you were you took a little bit of more of a hike. And if you were not so good, you put on your hiking shoes. But you see who they were, their exact madrega they wore on their shirt sleeves. Because if you were to sin, suddenly the mun the next day was no longer by your doorstep. It was further away. And all your neighbors suddenly know, ooh, I wonder what Yankel did. Ooh, look at that. All of a sudden he's taking a hike. Meaning to say you couldn't easily sin. Hashem was there with them. And this was the ultimate Kollel society. They had nothing to do with their money. How is it possible that Moshe could say the money caused them to sin? The gold caused them to sin? And more than that, the mushel is rather difficult to understand. If you would like to destroy your children, I have a little quick and easy way to do it. Take an unfiltered iPhone and put it in their hands. And you will destroy your children, guaranteed. Only a question of time, only a question of how much time, but within a short amount of time, your child will be totally destroyed. That is a clear example of taking a young man, putting him on the foot of the house of repute. If you put an unfiltered iPhone in the hands of a teenager today, you are begging for your child to end up in places that you wouldn't imagine, you wouldn't dream about in your wildest dreams. That is clearly an example of what Rashi is saying. But how does that refer to gold? Okay, Hashem, you gave them too much gold. And so it's like putting an unfiltered iPhone in a kid's hand. It's like putting a young man on the footstep of a base of Zonas. How does that compare? What does it mean? It's not possible for them not to sin. Hashem, you gave them so much money. How is it possible that they didn't serve Avodah Zarah? And number one, they had nothing to do with the money. This was the Kollel society living in the desert. And number two, how does gold, how does riches lead a person to idol worship? This Rashi sounds very difficult to understand. And I'd like to see if we could shed some light on it. And to do that, what we have to do is we have to sort of deal with our perception of money, how we view it, what it means, what it stands for, and particularly something that's rather unique in our current culture, and that's something called the love of money. Let me start with the following observation. Apparently one time I wasn't feeling so well or something, and someone said to me, you know, you look like $1 million. I said, I do? He said, yeah, all green and crumply. Now, if you think about it, that's an interesting observation. Because if you take a dollar bill or a $100 bill, you'll notice that it really isn't that attractive. It really doesn't have any inherent value. As a matter of fact, it's just green and crumply. And if you think about it, money shouldn't work. I could take a $100 bill and trade it for commodities, for goods. I can go into a store and buy with it. But that makes very little sense because the money has no intrinsic value. And the Chovos Vavos explains to us that this is one of the wonders that Hashem created in the world. He says if you understand money, you'll understand it all begins with gold. Gold was the first form of currency, and until recent times it was the backing of all currencies, certainly the United States and much of the world. But it explains the Chovos Vavos, the love of gold is not a logical, understandable love. Why? Gold has no innate value. It's soft and not very useful. You can't eat it. You can't plow with it. There's very little you can do with gold. Yet man has a love for gold, has a love for gold to the extent that everyone values it, everyone wants for it, and explains the Chovos Vavos, there's a particular reason for that. And that is because Hashem wanted mankind to succeed. And for mankind to succeed, a currency is very, very important. You see, it's very difficult for me to trade 100 pounds of my sheep shearings for a dining room set, or 20 pounds of potatoes for a pair of shoes. It's very difficult to exchange goods unless you have a currency. But to have a currency, there has to be something that everyone agrees is of value. Everyone agrees it's the scale of measure. But to do that, there has to be something that has a sort of attraction, that has this sort of value. And the Chovos Vavos explains that Hashem put into mankind an almost irrational love for gold so that there should be currency, and so that there should be value placed on it, so that now you have a system of commerce. A pound of gold is worth so many, and so much and so much. Now you could trade your sheep, you could trade your shoes. You now have a currency with which to trade. Now, if you would like to see this irrational love of gold, I'll share with you a little thought experiment. The largest bill in the U.S. Treasury is a $100,000 bill. Now, a few of us have ever seen it because it's really used for interbank exchanges. But I want you to imagine for a minute that there is a stack of $100,000 bills and I place it into your hand. And when I place it into your hand, there's a gauge measuring your blood pressure. What do you think is going to happen? I almost guarantee your blood pressure is going to... Now, the money is not yours. And I didn't say you can keep the money, and you know you're going to have to give the money back, but just holding a large stack of $100,000 bills, oh my goodness, do you know the value? Do you know how much this is worth? But what do you mean worth? You're not buying it. It's not yours. And you can't do anything with it. But it has such a, wow, do you know what? Millions of dollars in my hand. Oh my goodness, that's incredible. And there is a love of money that's in mankind's heart. And again, it's for exactly this purpose, so that currency has value. When my son was a little guy, he used to love counting money. Didn't have to be his money. He would love counting money. One time I said, why? He said, it's just fun. He would sit counting stuck of money. It's fun. And if you think about it, it's very, very interesting the way we approach money. And I'll share with you one interesting way to understand this. Most of us probably could figure out how to get by on $10,000 a day. And I imagine that you had $10,000 a day to spend, so I think most of us could figure out a way to eke it by, right? I mean, let's say the first day I take care of my mortgage, kids' tuition, food bills. Next day I buy a boat, save up a few days, buy a fancy sports car. $10,000 a day to spend is probably enough for most of us to get by on. Okay, why do I say that? Because to make it now into the 25 richest people in the world, into that category, you have to have a tidy sum of money. And basically, you have to have around $50 billion. And those 25 richest people in the world have each a net worth of about $50 billion. Now, $1 billion is $1,000 million, right? So let's do the math. Let's say you were to spend $10,000 a day. If you were to spend $10,000 a day, every day for a year, after that year's time, you would have spent about $3.5 million, which means to spend $1 billion, it would take you about 273 years. Spending $10,000 a day, you would never, ever be able to spend $1 billion. If you were to spend $100,000 a day, it would take you 27 years to spend $1 billion. Now, if you have $50 billion, I have to imagine you have enough money to live. Take the first billion and take care of your needs. The second billion you spend, make it $2 billion. You could spend $100,000 a day, every day, and you're probably not going to spend two of your $1 billion in your entire lifetime. Yet, interestingly enough, all of the people on the 25 richest list work for a living. But not just they work for a living, they work very, very long, hard hours. And they're very driven and very ambitious. And you got to ask yourself, gee golly, why? Now, maybe you'll tell me they're doing it for build the empire, build change markets. If you study, yes, it's true. There's some people there. There's a Bill Gates who really is apparently dedicated to things beyond just money. And most of his time is not spent at Microsoft. And maybe even Jeff Bezos now to some extent. But if you look at the vast majority of very, very wealthy people, they work hard, but not just hard, harder than you and I work. Even though they can't possibly spend the money, even though they spent their whole life, they couldn't spend the money they already have. And they're very driven, very ambitious to make more money, more money, more money. And the reason is because money has a tremendous allure, a tremendous pull. And if you'd like to understand the Dorodea, this generation, they had nowhere to spend their money. No shops, no internet, no e-commerce. They had nothing to do with their money, but they had money. They had money, and even though they were the Kollel society, and even though they experienced Hashem, money had real value. Money had a real pull, and it changed them. It affected them, even though they could do nothing with it, even though they understood the value of life. Nevertheless, money had its pull. Money affected them. So if you'd like to understand how money could affect you, even if you're in that living in the desert, the answer is money has a natural pull. But there was another question we asked that doesn't have an answer. And that is, okay, I get it. They were influenced. They were affected. But how does it lead one to idol worship? How does being wealthy, being phenomenally wealthy, how does it lead you to serve idols? There seems to be very little connection there. And to understand the answer to this question, I'd like to share with you three cultural beliefs about money. And as we begin peeling off the layers of these three cultural beliefs, we'll find some rather peculiar understandings that we have. Let's deal with the first. The very first cultural belief about money is more money equals more happiness, right? If I have some money, I'm somewhat happy. More money, I'm more happy. If I could have loads and loads of money, wow! If I could have that much money, I'd be so happy, because more money equals more happiness. And that is a pretty well-established cultural belief. Now, let's sort of ask ourselves the question, is that true? Is it true that more money equals more happiness? So let's deal with a couple of studies. There was a study done about major lottery winners. These were people who won phenomenal sums of money. We're talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And the study was looking to see what did people do with their time and what did they do with their life after they won it big. Interestingly enough, 80% of major lottery winners were back at work within 1 year's time, most of them at the same job they had been at before. Now, that's rather peculiar. Why? Imagine you have Joe, the UPS driver, right? Joe's in his brown shorts, Joe in his brown socks, Joe in his brown cap, all day long driving. And every day you hear Joe say the words, man, a couple of million, I'm out of here. Get me, what, you know, a dollar and a dream. Hey, you never know. And every day Joe buys a lotto. Every day Joe's at it. And one day he wins. Whoa, $260 million. Wow. And a year later, he's back in brown. But why? Really, it's quite simple. Joe won the $260 million, and he began spending it. What is phenomenal. He quits his job, and he goes out on a spree and buys a Mercedes-Benz in every color in the rainbow, goes traveling the world, goes bungee cord jumping off the Eiffel Tower, does everything imaginable. And after a couple of months, he says to himself, okay, but now what? So he does another vacation, does another little spree, and after a year, he's back in Brown, back at the job. And 80% of major lottery winners are back at work within 1 year's time. That's study number one. Study number two also looked at lottery winners, but compared them to a different segment of people. They studied two groups of people. One were people who won the lottery, a major lottery, and the second group of people were people who became a paraplegic. They lost at least two limbs. And the question was analyzing their life survey, their satisfaction with life. And after a year's time, sociologists asked each group to assess their happiness in life, how they rate their life, how they feel about it. And here's what they found. There was almost no noticeable difference in happiness between the group that had won lottery a year ago and the group who had lost their legs a year ago. The only significant difference was the group had become paraplegics described taking more joy in their day-to-day living than did the other group. Now, isn't that strange? All I need is a couple of million, 100 million, I'd be so happy. And I got it. So why aren't I happy? What's the matter? And Richard Earlstein, who is an economic historian in the University of Southern California, did an eye-opening study. He compared the relationship of increasing income and happiness, and he found that there was no correlation. In fact, he says that within the past 50 years of his study, the United States average income had doubled, and yet there was no increase in life satisfaction, no increase in happiness. I mean to say, people at the end of those 50 years had twice as much consumable goods, twice as much income, and twice as much money to spend, but there was no increase in the amount of happiness. And interestingly enough, this is cross-culture as well. I'll share with an interesting observation. People in Poland are about as happy as people in Japan. But oddly enough, the people in Japan are 10 times wealthier than the people in Poland. Poles are about as happy as Hungarians, even though they both have about the same level of wealth. People in Iceland are much happier than people in America, even though, again, they both have about the same level of wealth. And here's what Richard Earlstein discovered. That once you get beyond subsistence, once you have enough that you could pay your food bill and you basically have a place to live, more income has no correlation whatsoever to more happiness. The more money you make, the more money you spend, but it doesn't increase happiness whatsoever. And I hate to date myself over here, folks, but you remember Fiddler on the Roof? If you don't, you could just say you read about it in Wikipedia. But there was a song, If I Were a Rich Man, didle, 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 right? If I were a rich man, that was the dream. If I had money, if only I had money, and if only I had lots and lots of money, wow, life would be astonishing. Life would be phenomenal. And yet, it's not true. Because that cultural belief that more money equals more happiness is false. And oddly enough, we sort of know that, and we sort of understand it. Yet in our operating mode, in our operating world, it seems that we forget it. And this understanding, the first cultural belief that more money equals more happiness, is bunk. Okay, let's go on to the second cultural belief. The second cultural belief about money, I sort of discovered in an interesting way. A number of years ago, I was in a bank, and I was opening an account. And when it came time for the overdraft protection, the person, bank employee, said to me, what's your net worth? My net worth. I said, what am I worth? What am I worth? Now, I never thought, what am I worth? I never thought about it. I mean, if I put myself on the open market, how much could I sell myself for? What's my value? I don't, you know. So I said to him, you probably mean my financial net worth. And I gave him a number. And it hit me as a very interesting thing. And it's not just a little sort of quirk in our language. You see, many, many people have this understanding that my self-worth is tied to my net worth. I'm just a regular guy. But if I were wealthy and really, then I'd be really, really an important person. And you could see people apparently to some level think that way. What are you worth? You ever notice some people walk into a shul? The guy walk into a shul, he's not a big Talmud Chacham, not even a great tzaddik, and not even a very kind fellow. Look at that guy. You know what? I hear he's worth $10 million. I heard he had sold his business. He's worth $100 million. Wow. And oddly enough, it's not a figure of speech. We look at people, and their worth seems to increase when they have a few more dollars in the bank. And this is the second cultural belief, that my net worth and my self-worth are tied. That my net worth is equal to my self-worth, and my self-worth is the same as my net worth. Now, I'd like to share with you something the Chofetz Chovos tells us. He says there are three reasons why Hashem will grant a person wealth. And you could look at the person and know from how he uses his money exactly why he was granted that money. Great wealth could be a bracha, it could be a blessing, it could be an assayin, it could be a test, or it could be a klala, it could be a curse. And as the person uses the money, you can tell exactly which it is. Explains the Chofetz Chovos. The person becomes very wealthy, becomes very, very wealthy, and he becomes a different person. He starts dedicating his time differently, he starts dedicating his time to the Klal Yisrael, he starts learning more, davening more. He doesn't get sucked into the picture, but rather he becomes much more focused on what he could do with his time. You're looking at a person who is given a bracha that is a blessing. If you see a person who makes a lot of money, and suddenly he's busy and worried, how am I going to keep it, I'm making more money, and he's driven, he's working more and more, you're looking at a person who's in an assayin, in a life test. And if you see a person who spends his money opulently, and he buys the fancy homes and the string of homes and the mini cars and the island in the Pacific, you're looking at a man who's cursed because he's eating his world to come in this world. Many times Hashem will grant a person like that wealth because he did something really, really worthy, but Hashem doesn't want to pay him back in the world to come. He's not worthy of that. And therefore, he eats up his world to come in this world. And again, as a person uses it, you can tell exactly why he was granted that money. And a very funny thing happens to many people when they become rich. Let's imagine for a minute, I sold my business for $100 million and now I'm rich. Wow, I'm rich. Now, I used to be kind of like you guys, but to be honest with you, I'm no longer the same. You know, for me to drive the same kind of car as you, come on. For me to wear the same kind of clothes as you, come on, I'm a rich guy. I can't live in the same house or maybe even the same neighborhood as you because I'm sort of different. I'm a very rich guy. And with that riches comes another sort of sense. You know something? I have a lot of power. I can control things. Matter of fact, I don't need anybody. I don't need my kids. I don't need my wife. I don't need God. I can buy and sell the city. Great wealth causes a sense of independence. If you don't know how to use it, it becomes a part of you. I become the rich guy. I become above you, better than you. I become very, very independent, and I don't need anyone. And if you'd like to understand how the Dor Dea, that generation, could come to Avodah Zarah, it's very simple. They became rich, really rich. They left with all of the wealth of Mitzrayim, hundreds of years of wealth that was gathered. Mitzrayim had all the wealth of the world. Remember when Yosef was selling the wheat, everyone sold all of their gold to Mitzrayim, and all of the wealth of the world effectively was in Mitzrayim. And the Jewish people left with such hordes of gold, and apparently on some level it affected them, and they had that sense, I'm rich, I'm independent. And the minute I'm rich, I'm not dependent, I don't need anybody, I don't even need Hashem. And apparently on some level that led them to Avodah Zarah, it led them to idol worship. And I believe this is very, very eye-opening. The first cultural belief that we share is this cultural belief that more money equals more happiness, and it's false. It's predicated on a lie, it never works. And the second cultural belief is that my net worth and my self-worth a tithe, and that's only if you misunderstand money. And if you believe that you are the owner of the money and you become that rich person and you think your self-worth increases, and what you're doing is you're living a lie. And then you're going to have that sense of, I'm rich, I'm important, I'm independent, I don't need anyone. And it leads you to various things, and it led to Dardea, in fact, to this point of serving idols. But there's one more cultural belief about money that we didn't touch on yet. And this is maybe the most interesting one. And the third cultural belief about money is that the big spender is the rich man. Whoa, look at the car he drives. Look at the house he lives in. Look at his clothing. The big spender, wow, he's rich. Everybody else, you know, whatever, but he's rich. And this is a cultural belief that the big spender is the rich man. And I'd like to share with you, it's not so simple. And let me explain to you what I mean. Now, I want you to imagine there are two men. Each of them, after taxes, have a certain amount of money. Man number one, after taxes, is making $350,000. Not too bad. Man number two, after taxes, making $100,000. Now, there's no question, man number one is far wealthier and certainly making more money, and obviously he's the rich guy, and man number two is whatever. Until you look at their spending habits, and when you make $350,000 a year after taxes, but spend $400,000 a year, a very interesting thing happens. Yes, you live in a big fancy house. Yes, you drive a very nice car. But what happens is you go deeper and deeper and deeper into debt because you're not putting any money in savings. And Mr. Two was only making $100,000 a year, managed to put $20,000 a year in savings. And after 20 years with interest and investments, he now has $1 million in the bank. But this is the key distinction. Man number two has a simple way of living. $1 million is real wealth to him. You know why? Because real wealth means I could do with my time what I choose to do. And real wealth means I'm free to actually spend my life as I feel is appropriate. I don't have to spend my life working. Man number one who spent all his money and his house is now old and decrepit and his car is whatever and his debt has increased has built no wealth. And this belief that the big spender is the rich guy is absolutely false. And it's a cultural belief that we all buy into and somehow we all get sucked into, and it's so false that it's almost comical. And let me share with you exactly what I mean. Here are two cars. Now, I drive a Toyota Camry. Not a very fancy car, not a very expensive car. You could buy a new Toyota Camry, maybe $25,000. You want to deck it out fancy, $30,000. Okay. Now, let's assume that you don't want to be Santa's. Toyota Camry, come on, that's for rabbis. I need a BMW 760 Li, the 700 series, right? Come on, I need a... Now, the sticker price on the BMW 760i is $180,000. Now, that's a mighty expensive car. And the difference between a Camry at $25,000 and make it $30,000 and the BMW at $180,000 is $150,000. So the BMW costs you $150,000 more than does the Camry. Now, what does the BMW do for you? So all you got to do is look in the ads for the performance cars, and you'll see exactly what it does for you. Turbocharged engine, comfort system, responsive handling, experience something like no one else can experience. And it might be true, but if you actually get behind the wheel of the car, you find that it drives much like a Toyota Camry. As a matter of fact, there is no real distinguishable difference. What do you mean? Come on. The BMW can do 0 to 60 in 5.4 seconds. That may be true, but never in my life have I needed to go from 0 to 60 in 5.4 seconds, and I probably got arrested if I did. But come on, BMW has a top speed of 185. That may be true, but I am not doing 185 on the U.S. highway system. Oh, but come on, the BMW can take a hairpin and going downwards. But I don't drive that way. I'm not a race car driver. I'm a rabbi. I'm a school teacher. Maybe I'm a businessman. But one thing for sure, I'm not an Indy 500 race car driver. So if you could explain to me what the BMW does for me that the Toyota Camry doesn't, I'd be hard-pressed to see the difference. Oh, but come on, you know the Mercedes ad. You know, the Mercedes ad, you're in the stadium, and the Olympic winners are there, number two, number three, and you see the top position, the gold winner, he's not there. And then the ad, wild crowds, intense satisfaction, unequaled glory. Hop into Mercedes-Benz E500 sedan, and you'll find out what real thrill is about, and you see the winner of the Olympic gold medal is actually driving away for the real thrill as opposed to winning the gold medal in the Olympics. Now, that is a mighty good sales job, but if you have an IQ above an orangutan, you probably realize that it's very, very false. It really isn't true. The car does nothing for you. There's only one thing the car does. It says, I spent money. Look at me. Pay attention to me. I must be the rich guy because I'm the big spender. But guess what? It does nothing for you other than say the words, you're a big spender. But if you're not quite sure that it's not the wisest investment, let's look at the cost of owning a BMW 760 Li versus the cost of owning a Toyota Camry. Now, if you buy your 760 Li, your $180,000 car, and you go to sell it after 3 years, you're going to find you're not going to get $180,000 for it. As a matter of fact, you're going to get about $50,000. That means it's going to depreciate in value about $130,000 in 3 years. Matter of fact, the first year alone depreciates over $50,000. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. Imagine that you were to spend $130,000 over 3 years, meaning a little over $40,000 a year. That's what the car is costing you. Now, if you do the math, we're saying about $800 a week, about $110 a day, every day that it sits in your driveway, $110 out of your bank account. $110, $800 a week, $40,000 a year. And what does it do for you? Oh, come on. I'm the big spender. Look at me. Pay attention to me. You see who I am? And that's all it does. And if you'd like to buy into the myth, you can buy into it. But I'd like to share with you, the big spender is not the rich man. The rich man is the person who's actually financially independent. But he's the guy who lives simply. He's not the guy who's splashy. He's not the guy spending all the money. By the way, read The Millionaire Next Door. It's a book well worth reading. And you quickly find out that the really wealthy people are not the splashy guys. Because there's only one secret to wealth. Only one. There's only one secret to wealth. Are you ready for this? This is it. This is the big secret. I want you to hold on. Take a deep breath. Here we go. Are you ready? The secret is spend less than you earn. Spend less than you earn. It doesn't matter how much you earn. If you spend more than you earn, you will be poor. If you spend less than you earn, you will begin building wealth. But that secret, they don't sell you in the Mercedes-Benz ads, not in the BMW ads, not in all of Madison Avenue's ad campaigns. And I'd like to share with you what this last myth, this big spender, is the what rich guy leads us to. It leads us to the current times. We live in the consumer age. Consumer age. You'll hear that term all used, the consumer age. Now, I'd like to share with you what a consumer is. A consumer is one who consumes. Consuming means you eat, you swallow. And if you think about it, all the goods that you buy today are consumable. A shirt will only last one season because then it's out of fashion. A suit only lasts so long. A refrigerator is not going to last 50 years, probably not 20 years, because it's all planned obsolescence. You are a consumer. You're being educated, propagandized to consume, to eat more and more, consume, consume, consume. And on an ongoing basis, all day long, you're being assaulted by the message, spend, spend, spend. It'll make you happy. You'll be finally happy, joy-filled. Those who don't know how to shop can't find happiness. But if you know how to really spend money, then you know how to buy happiness. But it's a lie. More money doesn't equal more happiness. More consumable goods won't make you happy. But if you're propagandized all day long on social media, on regular media, on bus ads, and the newspaper ads, wherever you get your news, you're going to see it and hear it again and again, and you're going to hear the message, all you need to be happy. All you need to really be happy is more money And guess what? It doesn't work. And the second myth that the culture pounds us with is if you have a lot of money, then you're an important person. But you're a nobody. You don't even have $1 million in a bank. What are you? You're nobody. And if you understand that Hashem says the entire world, I would create the entire world for one human being, and you recognize that 10 million, 100 million, a billion, billion dollars is not the net worth of one human being. The worth of one human being is beyond any number. But that's not the message we get. That's not the message we hear. And the worst of the cultural beliefs is the big spender. Ah, he's the rich guy. And living in a consumer environment, you're going to get that all day long. Spend, spend, spend. Then you're rich, then you're wealthy. And I'd like to share with you why this is the most devious and maybe the most damaging of all. You see, for the vast majority of us, maybe all of us, we buy our money. Money doesn't come free. Now, if you had a wealthy grandfather who left you $100 million, you had a wealthy uncle in Utah and left you a fortune, fine. But for the rest of us, the only way we acquire money is we buy it. We buy our money with the most precious commodity we have. We buy our money with our time. Because that's what we have on this planet. That's all we have, a few years and so much time. And every single dollar that you spent is bought with some of your time. So imagine you make X amount of money a year. Imagine you make $100,000, $200,000, $400,000. All you have to do is take your time and take the money you earn, divide it up, and you'll see when you're spending that money how much of your time you've now spent. And that's a very interesting way to look at any purchase, any acquisition. I'm now going to take the most precious commodity I have, my time, and I'm now going to buy a Rolex. Now, come on, a Rolex, come on, $20,000, come on. That doesn't tell time like a regular watch. Come on, I mean, it's a Rolex. On my wrist is a smartwatch, an Amazon smartwatch. I think it was $49 on a Lightning deal. It tells time so much more accurately than any Rolex. And it has so many more features. My granddaughters even play games on it. Your Rolex will never do that. The only difference between your $20,000 Rolex and my $49 Amazon smartwatch is one. Mine tells time accurately. Yours says the word, I spent a lot of money. But that cultural belief is the most expensive cultural belief because time is all we have and all the money we ever spent has been bought with time. And it's time to sort of wake up and understand that it's a lie. The first cultural belief is that money equals more happiness. It's not true. Lottery studies show it. The difference between a paraplegic and a grand lottery winner is nothing other than the paraplegic expresses having more joy. The reason why 80% of major lottery winners are back at work within 1 year is because after a while, okay, I got the money, but nothing changed. And I want to share with you the great secret. If you were unhappy before the money, all the money in the world will not make you happy. The only question is, if you were happy before you had the money, will you still be happy after you get the money? But more money does not equal more happiness. And it's a cultural belief that's fostered or pounded with over and over, and it's just not true. And that second cultural belief that my net worth, if I were worth $10 million, then I'd be an important person. But me, I'm a little nobody. It's sheker v'kozev. Because money is green and crumply, and money doesn't make you worth anything. It doesn't change anything other than maybe paying some bills, but it doesn't make you worth a dime. But again, the third cultural belief, the most pervasive and most damaging, is that the rich man is the big spender. If he spends a lot, he's rich. If you spend a lot, you're buying poverty. The only way to acquire wealth is to spend less than you earn. I think this Chazal shares with us a tremendous insight. Even the Dordea, even the generation that just a few weeks earlier heard Hashem say, Anokhi Hashem Elokecha, were influenced by money. They were changed by it. They were changed by it to the extent that Hashem had to answer. Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, Hashem, you caused it. Ata garamti, you caused it. Why? Look how much money you gave them. They had such wealth. You know what it's like? It's like you're taking a young man and putting him on the Pesach Beis Hazonos on the prostitute's door. What are you doing? Hashem, you caused it. And Hashem agreed. Why? Because that is the danger of wealth. And wealth can be a tremendous bracha if you use it as it's supposed to be. If you dedicate your time to learning, to dominating, to to helping the Jewish people, to doing what you should be doing in life, then it's a tremendous bracha. But wealth has a very real danger to it. And that danger is, I become rich. I become the rich man. I become powerful, independent. I don't need anyone. I don't need my family. I don't need my kids. I don't need God. I am rich. And that is such a dangerous influence that even the Dardea led them to Varazara. And I believe this Chazal shares with us an eye-opening concept. And I want to close with one last observation. Someone once heard the Chafetz Chaim pick up a sefer and said, "Oi, oi." And it sounded a little strange, because it sounded like the Chafetz Chaim was regretful that he had the sefer. And so the person asked the Chafetz Chaim, "It sounds like Chafetz Chaim not happy with that sefer. Why?" Chafetz Chaim said, "I've never opened the sefer once. And I bought it. I paid money. And the only way I get money is with time. That means I spent some of my time for something that gave me nothing. Oi, it was a waste of money." Do you understand what that means? Chafetz Chaim so valued every minute of his life that when he spent money on a sefer that he didn't open, he felt he didn't invest that time wisely. Any money we acquire, any money that we spend, was bought with the most precious commodity, time. You have to spend money because it's a part of life. And you also have to understand money properly, and you have to understand the influence, the effect. If you have it and you use it properly, it's a bracha, or it's an assign, or it's a klala. It's all about understanding it, all about using it as you should. And now I'd like to open the floor to questions, thoughts, observations. I'd also like to take a drink because my voice is shot. I apologize. But that gives the shy people a chance to now raise their hands. They raise their hands and raise your hand and save a voice. I have a cold. I must have a cold or something. Yeah. Okay, Avram Scheinberg, is your hand up? Hopefully he'll allow you to talk, because somebody will talk, somebody brave. Hi. Good evening. Hi, how are you?
Shalom, how's everything?
Thank God.
So two questions. One is even with a certain amount of money, can one balance for Parnassa, could they daven also to have not to be rich, but to have a little bit more than what his parnasa has to be, to have a little something extra?
Yep.
Or is even that is something already stepping over into the try to be avoid being
right? Okay, it's a good kind of being rich. Right. It's a good question. So there's nothing wrong with wanting to have more than what you need. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be comfortable. The only question is, where do you spend your time, how much value it has to you, and the impact it has upon you. So, if you're a person who you're going to use your time properly, and you daven to Hashem that you should be effective, and let's say you make a little more, and it can be a tremendous bracha. Again, by the way, even tremendous wealth can be a bracha. The problem is, it's very dangerous. So, there's certainly nothing wrong with being comfortable, and if you have the opportunity to make more money, the only question you have to ask yourself is, what is it going to cost me? Is it worth the investment? Let's assume I have to work another hour a day, but thereby we could have much more yeshiva das and nachas ruach, because we'll have more money and there won't be as many worry. Maybe it's worth it. It might be a very good investment. On the other hand, if you have to sleep under the desk and it really costs you your family and your world to come, then it's not worth it. So, you know, there are two questions you have to ask yourself. One is, what does it cost me? Two is, what is the effect? There's nothing wrong with wanting to have, you know, enough more than to pay my bills, enough to put money away. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with asking Hashem for that. Because again, I don't think that's going to really have the impact we're discussing. And the only questions come in, how much time is it worth? And then ultimately, if I do get more, and especially if I get a lot more, what do I do with it? How does it impact me? How does it affect me? Okay, good. Okay.
I do have a second question.
A follow-up? Okay, go ahead. Follow-up. Yes, sir.
Is, if let's say somebody does get that big raise, they end up getting that large amount of money that could be potentially, then, as I said, could be the sign, or it could be eating up his next world a little bit. At that point, what can one do to sort of, I guess, not knowing which one it is, what can he do to, I guess, secure that it's not eating up the next world as opposed to more?
Right, that's a good question. So first of all, if it's a raise, you don't got to worry about it. You're not going to get wealthy on a raise. Unless maybe you make partner in a law firm if you're in business or if you're, you know, but let's even assume, whatever the case may be, let's assume you're right. Let's say you get to that point where you've made a fortune of money. I mean, you're making a lot of money. At that point, you have to recognize exactly what you're in. You're in a potential situation. It might be a bracha, it might be a test, it might be a curse, and it's up to you to determine what it is. Because you either get sucked into it and it ruins you, and in fact, it'll eat up your world to come. And by the way, I've seen many people become wealthy and they become obnoxious, arrogant buffoons. And they become nasty people, they get divorced, the kids hate them, and I've also seen people who made a lot of money who become very, very holy Jews. I'll share a story. I happen to love this story. There was a fellow in my shir, he was a regular guy, and he went into business, and he did pretty well. I used to learn with him once a week on Friday, and at a certain point he said to me, "Rebbe, next week I can't make it. I apologize, but the governor wanted a breakfast with me, and it was the only time he could make it. I'm sorry, I can't make it next week." Okay. Why did the governor want to have breakfast with him? Because the state owed him $62 million, and the state wanted to beg forbearance, a little more time to pay the debt. He was a guy who was a regular guy in my shir, became so wealthy. I mean, you can't even describe his wealth, and I want to share with you, he didn't change an iota. He once got upset with me because I spoke to him in a way differently than I did when he was 17 years old in my shir. Why do you treat me differently? That's a guy who has the money, and it's a bracha. It's a bracha because then he has time to learn, to daven, to take care of the Jewish nation, invest his money wisely. That means, what stuck organization can I help? Can I foster? Can I turn? How could I change things? And that's a person who's given it as a bracha. If it's an asayan, you just become busier and busier, more and more involved, whether it be in keeping your money or making more money. If it's a klola, that's a guy who spends and just... So, again, really it's up to you. Oftentimes, if you're given the extra wealth, you're able to decide what to do with it. But again, you can tell by the way a person uses it what it was given for. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, good, good. Okay, Avi, you have the floor.
Okay, great. Can you hear me?
I can, yes, hi.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much for giving this year. It was great. Definitely gave me a perspective on what to do with money whenever there's some extra money around. One thing that I was hoping that would be addressed is just that I feel like in the Jewish community, in our various firm communities, we live in bubbles that the rest of the world doesn't live in. And first of all, you need to make an incredible amount of money just to be able to pay tuition and a basic home. I live in a very basic home. We're happy with our house? Great. But we have to make an incredible amount of money in order to pay tuition, and I have to be on scholarship. And in our shul's rebuilding, right? So they put on the wall, here's who's donated this amount of money. We're not there yet, but everyone should know, these are the guys, they donated all of this money. And the school that we send our kids to, every few times a year, this is who donated for this community, you know, this campaign or that. And, you know, you live in a feeling of like, wow, you know, I'm working very hard, I'm earning a good amount of money, but it's not enough. And yet, if I had a little more, then I could donate to this or that, and my name could be there. I just feel like we live in a different type of setting than the rest of the world. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about how we deal with this money thing, you know, being a firm Jew and keeping our head on straight.
Yep. That's the key, keeping your head on straight. You're right. It's the obligations of a Jewish household today, the financial obligations are beyond description. The average, we discussed in the previous year, to make ends meet in the firm world, you have to earn what the top 1.5% of United States of America people earn. I mean, you have to be earning in the 1.5% top earners to be making ends meet in the firm world today. And that is something that not all of us are exactly equipped to do. Either I don't have the talents or the schooling or whatever it may be. I just, that much money. So it is a major issue. It's a major problem. It's also a major nesayon because I want my name up on the wall. And maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's worth my, you know, giving up my comfortable job because I can now get a little more honor, a little more covered. And it is a big nesayon and it's a big difficulty. And it's also, by the way, one of the greatest nisim I've ever seen in my life. The fact that we're all somehow able to own homes, pay tuition, and somehow it works out. I own a home. I have kids, my kids are older now, but they all went through yeshivas and seminaries, the whole deal, and somehow it works out. And if you study this phenomena, I mentioned this in previous years, one of the greatest nisim of modern times, that somehow almost no one I know goes bankrupt, almost no one I know was evicted from their home. And so you're right, it is a nesayon, it's a very difficult nesayon, and it's difficult, but you're right, that's the times we live in. We're living in blessed times, that there's tremendous wealth, but there's also tremendous demands on spending money, and some of it you can't avoid, meaning at the end of the day, you're going to have to pay tuition, you have to buy a house, you have to drive a car, you have to wear clothing, so there's a certain amount you have to spend, and you're right, it's one of the great nesayonos of our day, and keeping your head on straight is the key, not getting sucked up, not buying into the cultural myth. Oh, the big spender, he's got his name up, oh, he's the rich guy. I mean, again, that's good money, that's a good place to put your money, but again, it's costly, you know. Right. When your name is on the school building and your kids go in there, it's not so simple. I've heard more than one story of a kid saying to a Rebbe, don't go talking to me, my father supports this yeshiva, you don't tell me what to do. And it's not so simple, you know, so there, both sides have cost to it. All right. I don't know if that answers the question at all, but I agree with the question.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good
Shabbos. Okay, good Shabbos. Okay, good. Okay, Josh. Josh, you got the floor. Do you have
Shalom.
The floor? Shalom. Hi. Yep. How are you?
Good. Tov. How are you?
Good. Baruch Hashem.
Excellent. Baruch Hashem. Wanted to ask about, so I'm trying to understand how to formulate this question. Basically, like,
let me help you with your question. Based on your field, the goal is to make a lot of money. A lot of money. And that's what drives the field. And that's what the goal is. How do you deal with that? Is that the question?
That's part of the question. But the other part of it is that it's like we have this burning desire. Like, we change our financial goals, like, this year, mm-hmm. where it's like, not like, you know, 400,000, 500,000, 700,000 in commission. We're like, we look at the Meisser number. We're like, we need to achieve that Meisser number. And that's what's driving us every day to work really hard. Is that if we're trying to like get more so that we can do more? Like, I have this dream. I want to give anonymously like a Talmud, for example, to like a yeshiva or to like something like that, but totally anonymous.
Right. Okay, so let me put it this way. It's potentially a good goal, but it's a little scary, and I'll tell you why. Because, you see, what is it going to cost you to get that? Now, if you're able to do it, meaning you should work hard and set goals, and I'm all for that, absolutely, 100%. But when you have the goal, what is it going to cost you? How much of your life is it going to cost you? If you're able to work hard and do it and still learn, daven, be a family, you know, do what you're supposed to do, then go for it, do it. The minute it starts encroaching on the rest of your life, then suddenly it's no longer as holy as it was, because it's very nice to give stucco money, but there's a lot of other things that you're supposed to be doing, like everything else about your life. Meaning, Hashem doesn't need all the money that I could ever give to all the stuckas in the world. Hashem doesn't need my money. Hashem has lots and lots of money. Hashem gives us the opportunity to support various causes, to do things in this world. Those are schusim. Now, if I could do that easily without stealing from other things in my life, do it, absolutely. But if it's going to cost me, if I'm not going to be the same father, not going to be the same husband, I'm not going to daven the same, not going to learn the same, then it's not worth it. Why? Because you're buying at a huge expense. Yes, it's nice to give stucco, but it's costing too much. So you always have to balance what you're accomplishing with what it actually costs you. And again, the greatest, most precious commodity you have is time. And you have to invest your time very, very wisely. So, again, it's a good goal, but you have to kind of temper it with the understanding that it has to be bracketed with the totality of being a Torah Jew.
Thank you so much.
Okay, good. Thanks for joining us. Okay, I want to thank everyone for joining. I hate to cut now, but my voice is cut anyway. Again, if you haven't gotten a chance to subscribe to the Shmooze WhatsApp group, if you send a please subscribe to 845-216-9330. You get these short inspirational videos 3-4 times a week. We send them out. And that's a Shmooze Chizuk group. It's a WhatsApp group. The Shmooze Chizuk. If you want to join the Shmooze Chizuk WhatsApp group, just send a please subscribe to 845-216-9330. And there's still an opportunity if you haven't gotten the Two Worlds, One Chance, the Shmooze book. You can still get a copy. The copies are free. All I ask is that you participate in the cost of the shipping, but the books themselves were sponsored. If you go to book, book.com, theshmooze.com. Again, it's book.theshmooze.com. You go there, you'll see the description. Again, the book is free. All we ask is that you participate in the cost of shipping. Again, it's book.theshmuz.com. I wish you a good Shabbos. Hope to see you next week. Thank you.